Reignite on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. Whatever stage your business is at, there's always time to imagine sustainable, positive change. AIB, for the life you're after.
Welcome back to Reignite. Coming up, MSNBC TV host Chris Hayes on his instant best-selling book, The Siren's Call. Robert Waldinger on overseeing the longest-running happiness study in the world and what it teaches us. The charity helping homeless people into new jobs. And we get four newly opened businesses to do their elevator pitches. I'm Monia Kerr and this is Reignite. Get your WhatsApp messages into us on 0870 32 32 32. Text us on 51551. Email us on reignite@orshe.ie. And if you're out and about, we're now live on the Orshe Radio app. Now, first this morning, Chris Hayes is an Emmy Award-winning journalist and host of the MSNBC programme All In with Chris Hayes. He's now written an instant number one New York Times bestseller, which President Obama this week listed as one of his top 10 reads of the summer. Chris, you're very, very welcome to Reignite. We often talk about this idea of the attention economy and the attention crisis, but you're giving a lot of thought to what you're calling the attention age. Can you explain what you believe that is in this moment and what you're calling now attention being the most endangered resource of our time?
I think that the nature of how technology and capitalism have developed have created a situation in which attention is the defining resource of our age. I mean, if you think back to, you know, what's the defining resource of, say, the industrial age? It's probably fossil fuels and coal and things like that. It's the resource upon which all else depends in some ways. And my argument in the book is that our attention is the resource upon which all else depends increasingly in. And part of the reason for that is that it's a finite resource. The thing about attention is that it involves a kind of choosing. It can be in one place or another, right? There's a zero-sum battle for it. And because that attention is finite, because the quantity of it is capped, and there's more and more entities that want it from us in order to monetize, in order to use for their own political ends, there's increasing competition that drives up the value of that attention, both globally in terms of, you know, $100 billion companies and some of the most powerful companies in the world, and individually in our own subjective experience of life.
Which means then it's something that's very priceable, very tradable. Your book tries to go back, and it does it brilliantly, to tell the story, the sequencing, the timelines, how we came to this moment. What do you think was the point where how we think about engagement and attention and time well spent, what's the point at which it changed fundamentally?
I mean, I think if you had to sort of say what's the moment that this era began, you would say 2007 with the introduction of the iPhone. I mean, I think that's the kind of transformative moment where this entire new frontier of attention extraction gets unlocked. Because, you know, before that, people had desktops, they had laptops, but they did not have with them at all times, in every single moment, waking and sleeping, access to a computer and access to the internet and access for companies to your attention. And so if you're looking for like the moment that things shift over into what I would call the attention age, I really do think it's that, it's the beginning of the smartphone era. But one of the things I try to argue in the book is that, going back to a brilliant economist and political scientist, Herb Simon, who has a paper about this in the 1970s, when we think about the information age, which I think we, you know, the computer age, the information age, a digital age, whatever we call it, we all kind of understand intuitively that there's this change from like industrial production and, you know, physical manufacturing to the manipulation of symbols and information, right? Health claims processors and, you know, people that work in tech. We tend to think of that age as an age in which the valuable commodity is the information itself. And people talk about data and information. And the insight that Herb Simon has all the way back in the 1970s, and which I think is truer now than ever, is that information actually isn't the valuable thing. Information is basically infinite. You could have all the information in the world. The valuable thing is attention. And the really important thing, the insight that Simon has in this little paper that he gives in the 1970s is, information consumes attention, which is to say, the more information that we're confronted with, the more information there is in the ecosystem in which we operate, the more valuable attention becomes. And attention is actually the valuable thing. So as we've transitioned into this sort of information economy, what he recognizes earlier than most, and which is truer now than it's ever been, is that it's actually an attention economy that is at the core of what's happening.
And as you say, 2007 being this moment with the iPhone, and you describe the phone in the book, the Siren's Call, little slot machines we hold in our pocket. And you move forward 7 years to this study in University of Virginia in 2014. Just give us a recap, Chris Hayes, of what that study showed when it comes to unpleasant distractions that we get so consumed by the need for engagement and attention and affirmation and to be distracted. What happened in this study?
The experimenters asked experimental subjects who were, you know, college student volunteers to say, sit in a room by themselves for a period of time, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, it sort of depended. And then they asked them afterwards, you know, how did that feel? And they, by and large, said, I didn't like it. I was bored. I was restless. And then they did another study where they said, you can sit in the room, there's no stimulation. If you want to, you could administer yourself a shock, a little bit of pain that would interrupt the boredom. It would be something to do. And a shocking number of experimental subjects, many, many of the men, particularly, yeah, there's a huge gender divide.
67% of the men. And one participant seems to have spent basically the entire time shocking himself, administering 190 shocks.
Yes, exactly. I mean, and I just thought, I came across a study, I thought it was such a profound expression of something so deep within us. You know, I quote Pascal and his Pensée when he's writing about this, you know, back in the 17th century. And he says, you know, all the troubles of man derive from his inability to sit alone in his own chamber. And so this desire in us to sort of flee from boredom, the reality that our mind can be a feral beast, that we seek distraction and diversion, this is a profound thing about humans, right? In any age, I think even in the early parts of modernity, but it's been so exacerbated by the technological and economic incentives that we face in the world such that we always have a machine to shock us, as it were. The experimental subjects are just desperate for something. We always have that thing. It's the phone.
And if we're constantly seeking those dopamine hits, so we're getting overstimulated by the viral content, when we're restless and alone with our thoughts, we're afraid of our own loneliness or boredom, as you mentioned there, does it mean then when we're guilty of that infinite scroll and we're just scrolling through news feeds, what is that doing to our brains in terms of critical thinking, in terms of our values, our sense of human connection, even our empathy for those around us? Is it fundamentally changing who we are as human beings, say, since 2007 in particular?
I mean, I think it is. I mean, we all feel this, right? I mean, I don't think there's any question about our subjective experience of it. We feel our attention spans getting shorter. We feel the kind of addictive twitchiness, you know, like if you, you know, have had like smokers in your life who, like, you can see them pat themselves for their cigarettes, right? Like, and the look of panic that comes over their face if they don't have it. Like, we've all had that moment when we get to a coffee shop and we go to stand in line and we realize it's going to be 5 minutes, and then we like pat our chest for our phone. It's like, oh, I left it in the car. Now I'm here myself. So I think we all recognize that subjectively. I think there's pretty good evidence to suggest that it is making us less capable of complex and deep thought. You can see this in some of the global testing that's given to like 18-year-olds. We've seen a decline actually in lots of places. So I think it's having a negative effect on our cognitive abilities. But I think in some ways, to me, it's almost a spiritual question. I mean, to go back to that idea of sitting by yourself, you know, one of the insights that Pascal has is he talks about, you know, a king who's surrounded by all diversion and earthly pleasure, and that there's a kind of one-way ratchet. There's a trap, which is that the more diversion you have, the more diversion you need, such that the king has endless diversion. And yet if he's with his thoughts alone for a second, he starts to panic and he starts to feel despair. We're all in that kind of king's paradox. And I think there's something about what it does to us at a spiritual level, what it means to be a human, what it means to sort of be at home within our own mind that has been broken and corrupted, that is distinct from what might show up in testing or our cognitive challenges. It's really about the sort of status of our souls.
And you've been able, through the book, put on the analyst hat, the researcher hat, but you also are a very well-known host of a TV show and podcast, so All In with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. And therefore, you presumably think a lot about how am I going to get people's attention for this very important news story, news package that you might be presenting on a given day. But then how do you hold that attention? So has doing the research, the analysis, changed your approach as a broadcaster journalist now when you're dealing with your own audience?
I mean, I think it actually goes in the opposite direction, which is that the 10 years that I spent before I started the book of the practicing the craft sort of led to the book. Like the book is in some ways the result of me trying to theorize and think deeply about what I had been thinking about every day for a decade in doing my work, which was just the craft of trying to grab people's attention, hold people's attention. And so a lot of what comes out in the book are the insights gleaned from that. And the book is sort of the byproduct as much as anything. You know, the craft that you have to do every day, you learn about, you know, and in some ways it's, you know, there's certain technical things that you learn about how to hook people and things like that. But a lot of it is just the basic pillars of what in the ancient Greek tradition was called rhetoric, right? Like pathos, ethos, logos. Like you're trying to hold people's attention, you're trying to persuade, and you're trying to get your point across. And, you know, that is a craft, that is a technique. I do think that like different platforms and different attentional marketplaces incentivize or disincentivize different aspects of the palette that one uses to hold or keep attention. I feel lucky that like even as short form as cable news can feel at times relative to a 20-second video, it's actually quite in depth, right? Like everything is comparative. So, but at the same time, there's 3-hour podcasts as well. So there's different formats that do different things to us attentionally.
But we live in a time, I think it's probably fair to say, where we have fractured attention because of the multiple platforms and the multiple devices. And at a time when everyone is a publisher, what impact does that then have on democracies? And when we see US President Donald Trump, he's probably a pretty good symbol of your attention age right now and has figured out how to use negative and positive attention for his own gains and devices.
Yeah, I think he had this insight basically before anyone, and I don't think it was a theoretical insight. I think it was almost like a limbic system, like feral insight, born deep of his kind of personal experience and pathology, that attention is the most important thing, and having attention on yourself. I think he needs that at a almost sort of physical level because of who he is as a person, because of his psychological formation, which I think is like deeply, deeply broken. But he needs to be the center of attention at all times and has oriented his life in many ways around that and his political career, and has sort of discovered that the moment that he kind of launched himself, that actually is the most important resource. And so there's a hand in glove fit between his own instincts and the nature of the era we live in, such that he wants to dominate attention, and dominating attention turns out to be the most important route to power. And so he's the ultimate apotheosis of the attention age.
And floods the zone then in order to just...
Exactly, yeah.
I'm thinking of our listeners at this moment who might be like, okay, we get it. The attention age, this is an attention crisis. Time spent online is money spent. What are the solutions, Chris? Because I know in the book you try to kind of wrangle with then this idea of attention hygiene, that we're not completely powerless in this moment and we can take back our control. Can you give listeners a few simple tips in this moment?
Yeah, I mean, I think you sort of start with yourself and then build out. Because I do think there's many layers at which the problem has to be encountered. I mean, the first is just to go back to what we were saying before about sort of boredom or the twitchiness you feel if you're standing in line, you know, without your phone, is to actually insist that you can start out with 10 minutes, you can start out with 15, somewhere 10, 20, 30 minutes a day that you are just alone with your own thoughts, doing nothing but just with your own thoughts. For me, that's really useful to do during a walk. It might be doing like, you know, I think we've all got acclimated if you're, say, cleaning up the kitchen after dinner, that you like put a podcast in because you don't want that time to be, you know, but to not do the podcast during that period, to like create pockets of time intentionally and required of yourself and it could be small. It could be 10 minutes to start of just sitting with your own thoughts. That I think is actually a really fundamental thing. And I think it's almost like working out, like it's a muscle that you have to exercise and rehabilitate and make stronger and stronger. And then I think there's ways to think about how we relate to other people, which is to prioritize hanging out. This is something that I think has really increasingly been lost, but like being with other people in real life together, socializing, not mediated through phones, not mediated through devices, talking and hanging out, you know, like people getting together to do things, whether they're joining choruses or they're making music together or they're doing pottery together or whatever it is, to all of us to kind of direct ourselves back into an intentional way, communing with other people in real life, physically with each other, pursuing goals and projects together. And those are all sort of like social things. And then there's political things. I think actually one of the things I've spent a lot of time in the book in is that like the structure of the internet, the structure of market incentives and technological incentives really matter for how much our attention is being exploited and extracted and how much we feel like you have possession over it. And there's ways to think about regulating that. There's ways to think about creating non-commercial spaces on the internet that we used to have once upon a time that have largely gone by the wayside, that are less exploitative of attention. And then there's political movements. You know, in the US, there's this really interesting movement around the Strother School of Radical Attention, where people are getting together to try to like think about how to reclaim attention collectively, both as practice and as politics. So it sort of starts at the individual level, goes to sort of social level, and all the way up to the political level.
And staying with the political level, because I know you're coming to Ireland in the next few weeks on your own personal family visit. And here in Ireland, we talk a lot about regulations around AI, but trying to strike the balance with innovation, but with guardrails around it. And how do you not have unintended consequences when it comes to AI and innovations? We spend a lot of time then looking at our schools and increasingly policies in schools here in Ireland to ban the use of and access to mobile phones during the school day. There's been a lot of debate then here in Ireland around, well, is Australia now the model to follow, where they're effectively banning under 16s from using social media and therefore trying to kind of get back more to this radical focus and the hanging out and the lovely simplistic things you talk about there. Where do you think this falls on the political spectrum? And when you look at the US and maybe compared to Europe and Ireland within that, are there any countries that you think are getting parts of this right that might actually grapple with this attention age that you talk about in a new and different way?
The first thing I would say is that experimentation is kind of key, because everyone's sort of trying to figure it out. And there's, you know, there are people that I respect greatly who have long reasons that they think these sort of age bans might backfire or might not work. But I actually think it's pretty intriguing. And I think it's worth seeing what it does, actually. I think it's a worthwhile experiment, what they're doing in Australia. And I think it's probably worthwhile doing states. I think one of the things you just mentioned that I want to sort of focus on is, you know, American politics are extremely polarized. We all know that. This is one area where that polarization hasn't quite set in yet. Like, there's not really a left-right view of this. There are some, you know, there's the kind of political economy of how the tech barons operate and, you know, who they're able to control in Congress. But in terms of at the ground level, I think that people across the political spectrum with very different worldviews feel similarly, actually, about this set of questions. And I do think experimentation here is actually really key. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens in Australia. And again, I'm a bit agnostic about it. I think that some of the arguments against it sound to me like salient and possibly true. On the balance, I think trying to do this and seeing what it does is important. But the other thing I think is really important too is that going back to creating an open internet architecture is really important. And that has to happen at a regulatory level from all sort of players involved. We've been thinking about in the EU, it's been very privacy focused, right? It's been very sort of like data focused. But the thing to think about is like, we are losing non-commercial spaces in the internet. We have non-commercial spaces in real life. We have a mix of commercial spaces and non-commercial spaces, right? We have the sidewalk is a non-commercial space, and then the store is a commercial space, right? There's parks, there's public arenas, there's private homes. The internet has been sort of captured such that the platforms increasingly, which are commercial spaces, make up the entirety of the internet. And one thing I think it's really important to think about is, how do we reassert a non-commercial architecture on the internet? Something that existed 20 years ago,
get
right?
I mean,
there was
original,
a huge non-
original intent.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Exactly.
Finally, Chris Hayes, are you optimistic, pessimistic in this moment, given the book, The Siren's Call, given what you hear and see every night on MSNBC?
Well, I would say it's a kind of optimism of the will. One thing I really try to exert on myself is the self-discipline to recognize that, you know, I'm 46 years old, you know, change, and it's very easy to think that, you know, the world's going to hell in a handbasket. And there are lots of people doing lots of different things that are incredibly inspiring. And one of the things I feel optimism about is, I think that the degree to which there's a sort of consensus view of like the kind of textural experience of everyday contemporary life feels off in some way is actually quite promising. Like, people don't love the feeling of being on their phone all day, even if they're doing it. And that in that feeling inside your chest, in that kind of like the feeling of a kind of car sickness of the soul, that there is the beginnings of a rebellion against it and the creation of something new and different and better.
Well, hopefully, as people have been listening to you, we'll all try harder to convert that awareness, that feeling in the pit of our stomach where we actually don't feel maybe that was time well spent on our phone, and converting it into action and time well spent. Chris Hayes, congratulations on the book, The Siren's Call, How Attention Became the World's Most Endangered Resource. It has been such a pleasure to have you here on Reignite.